With the collapse of Soviet communism, the United States emerged as the world's only superpower. But our troubles weren't over. With the changes in political geography came a realization that the future well-being of the United States is dependent on the well-being of the rest of the world. We're seeing emerging hotspots of trouble and strife because of inequities in food supplies and safe, dependable sources of energy. If we do nothing, we'll witness the continued deforestation, desertification, and pollution of so much of the earth. But if we could find the answer to the question posed by R. Buckminster Fuller, how do you provide a quality standard of living for over 5 billion people and ensure the stability of our biosphere at the same time, we may make some progress. Peter Meisen is executive director of the Global Energy Network International, based in San Diego. GENI is a nonprofit corporation promoting research and education about interconnecting regional power systems into a single, continuous world electric energy grid. Peter Meisen joins us today. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
Do you have any observations on the discussion we've been having so far?
Yes. Machines can cause damage, or they can also be beneficial. And I think we're learning the consequences of that. And I'll use the example that I often do, that we have a very luxurious life in the Western world, and that's based on our energy use. Most of it provides our clean water, our health care, our communication, our infrastructure for us to have this, to be able to have the luxury of this conversation. But the problem is 80% of the time that you and I flip a switch for any kind of energy use at all, we're polluting. That's the toxics that come from either thermal generation or nuclear generation. And so machines can have their advantages as well as their consequences. And we're now, after the first few decades, really recognizing the consequences of our energy scenario. And what GENI is about is altering that energy scenario.
When Buckminster Fuller made his proposal about the world energy grid, that was 20 years ago. What were some of the technical limitations that stood as obstacles to implementation?
At that time, the efficiency of long-distance transmission was really only several hundred miles. And then NASA comes along, and we are able to take those new metallic alloys for conductors and ceramic insulators and put them into the utility industry and expand that transmission distance to 1,500 miles, which was significant because you can now connect time zones and start to even out the peaks and valleys of demand between time zones as well as seasonal variations north and south. Now, again, our scientists in this field have gotten much smarter. The efficient transmission distance by the industry stated is 4,000 miles. We don't have any of that on the ground yet today. We only have one country that's that large in terms of its size, and that's Russia. So we now have a technology that goes thousands of miles. If you do that radius around San Diego, that actually reaches into the central part of Latin America, all the way into Colombia, Venezuela, and even in through Canada into eastern Siberia in Russia. So we have an opportunity with the technology today to be able to import and export, the focus being renewable energy resources, the renewables being solar, wind, hydro, geothermal, tidal, and biomass from a tremendous distance for the mutual benefit of everybody in that radial sphere.
Well, there are tremendous political problems that would have to be overcome. But assuming that those obstacles are out of the way, what are the implications of a grid like that should it be set up?
Well, again, the opportunity to link the renewable resources has—it's easy in its initial statement, but has huge implications in many areas. We're actually then saying that 195 countries on a 24-hour basis would be linked economically, massive trade around the world like we've never seen before, and it just so happens that some of the best renewable resources are in the southern countries in the developing world, in Latin America, in Africa, and Asia. So they could actually become the generations sites for much of our renewable energy, connect those into North America and Western Europe, and start affecting some of that debt situation. So if you're exporting a renewable resource from Latin America to North America, and it's cheaper than our own energy resource, then that just makes good economic sense for us to buy it. It also has less pollutants coming out of the smokestack, and then dollars going back to Latin America for their development and their debt repayment. An exact same equation exists between Western Europe and Africa. On the environmental side, it's very clear. If you can start to make the transition to renewable resources and start to move away from the most polluting sources, you have less environmental damage. And so there's reports around that in terms of huge opportunities to change the course of the energy scenarios, which right now are 80-20 in their percentages of renewable and non-renewable, to the other direction, toward a more renewable energy source society.
Once you're crossing international boundaries, then what is the guarantee that, for instance, a power creating source in, I don't know, Nairobi, say, for instance, would be renewable, would be non-polluting? What would be a way of enforcing that?
There is no enforcement on any individual country, obviously. They're going to run their system basically based on economics, and that's how every utility makes their decision, is where's the cheapest source of power. And right now, unfortunately, that's been coal for the first part of this century, and we're learning our economic lessons from the nuclear side, which has been much too expensive, obviously. And the renewable resources, specifically the wind power, the variable speed wind generators, are now coming in at, the research shows, at 5.5 cents. Solar thermal, which is in the desert of Southern California and in Israel, is between 8 and 10 cents a kilowatt hour. That's very cost competitive, both for baseload and some peak need generation. So those technologies have improved dramatically over this last decade, even with very little funding.
As far as the expense of setting up the grid, you compare it to the costs of defense budgets of countries, because you're talking very big numbers. It's expensive.
Yes.
Well, once the grid is set up, though, what are the transmission costs?
The costs, there are losses that involved over transmission distance. Just like your hairdryer, the cord heats up. That's Ohm's law at work. And over a 4,000-mile distance, the international organization, the IEEE organization, basically has figured about a 20% load loss over that distance. And to build a transmission line, say, of 1,000 miles of a high voltage, say 765 kV, is about $1 million a mile. It's a pretty good rule of thumb. So for example, the Pacific Intertie that comes from Bonneville in Washington State to Southern California was about $1 billion to build. The Congressional Office of Technology Assessment last decade figured that had saved us already $20 billion in cost savings and reduction of oil that we might have had to import or resources we would have had to burn. This is just falling water that's there as long as the rains come. So enormous economic advantages. And the example here for San Diego, in the middle of the day, peak time of, let's say, 1 or 2 o'clock, when everybody's at work and the air conditioners are running full, that half of the power for this region comes from outside the area. It comes from Bonneville area, it comes from Arizona, it comes from Mexico, a geothermal plant in Mexico. And San Diego Gas and Electric has put those relationships in place because it's cheaper to buy it from a neighbor than it is to generate it domestically right here.
So we're already taking our energy from places outside the county. So instead of going 3 counties over or into the next state, why not go to, I don't know, Malaysia or something?
Well, again, that would be good for Southeast Asia. The real critical part of this discussion is there's two of them. For the first world, the developed world, there's about 1.5 billion of us that live in that condition. Again, we're the biggest polluters, and we have the opportunity to take the new technology that we have discovered and start to make that transition to renewable resource base, and at the same time being more energy efficient. There are many people out there talking about high compact fluorescent light bulbs and better window coverings. We need to be doing that to get to the energy usage comparable, say, with Japan.
It seems like, though, our trade with other countries in the past has been characterized by a lot of environmental imperialism, where we move all of the toxic, polluting, revolting industries that we don't want in our country off to some other country, and they provide the product that we want, and then we get it back that way at a bargain price. We make out, the other country doesn't make out at all, and their land is destroyed.
And they're still living in poverty. So there's 4 billion people today living in a very survival mode, and what that looks like is there's a woman in Africa that's walking 5 miles today. day to go get water that isn't even potable, and then she has to go find wood, which obviously is a deforestation conversation, just to cook and stay warm. 75% of Africa's heating and cooking needs are met by wood. None of us in the United States really do that. So they need another energy option, and that's what Fuller was really talking about, that the quality standard of life that he spoke about in the World Game proposal is really a function of enough energy to provide us with that water, that health care, that refrigeration of food and medicine, the sewage disposal, but to do it in a way that's clean at its use. So he looked at these renewable resources. They're massively abundant around the world. Everybody, Department of Energy and everybody else now has acknowledged that, that these resources are far beyond what we could ever, ever use or need around the planet. We just haven't gone down that path. It just so happens that some of the best ones, they're site-specific because you can't move a renewable resource. The desert is there, the mountain is there, the tidal plate. Plane is there, so you have to generate it where it's located and transmit it with the technology that exists today. Some of those linkages cross political boundaries. We already have many examples around the world. The United States has 100 interties into Canada. As I mentioned, we're connected into Mexico. All of Western Europe is interconnected, as well as the former communist countries throughout Eastern Europe. And right now, they're in the integration between East and West Europe because it makes good economic sense, and it has a good environmental component, too, to interconnect all of Europe.
Peter Meissen is a founder and director of special projects for the Global Energy Network International, based in San Diego. Our number is 594-8255. Continuing to join us is Dr. David Kyle. He's the author of Human Robots and Holy Mechanics, Reclaiming Our Souls in a Machine World, and it's newly published, available from Swan Raven and Company in Oregon. Our number is 594-TALK. Let's take a call now from Harold in El Cajon. You're on Tuesday.
Mr. Meisner's summary a few moments ago demonstrates the fact that corporations can free us from pollution, from disease, from our enemies, so as to enable us to find our soul. I take no small amount of umbrage with the doctor's earlier statements as to the perils of corporations. I think the perils might best be discovered in the genetics of individual men. Last Thursday, Dr. Diamond of UCLA spoke at great length on how our genetics are inappropriate to the reality today, that our genetics are attuned to the reality of 150,000 years ago, and I would want to give three cheers to corporations that permit cooperative action, and indeed have been a major event in the evolution of Western civilization, warts and all.
Well, let's let Dr. Kyle respond.
Well, I don't disagree with you that individual corporations, individual people are making really effort to bring about change. I'm talking of really about a larger historical context that we're in, and what Buckminster Fuller was talking about was looking at how you create technologies from a different value base. And part of my argument is the general value base that the not individual corporations per se, but the corporate economy worldwide has begun to create. I've worked with the Electrical Power Research Institute. I know some of the discussions that Peter is looking at, and there's a lot of effort to move toward renewable resources, but power utilities in this country and worldwide tend to make other kinds of decisions than just value-based decisions. And so it's a very complex situation that we're in. My argument is to have more ideas like Peter's. Part of my argument is that the basically 100 transnational corporations that determine a lot that goes on in the world. We need lots more diversity in our thinking, lots more new ideas that push out in other kinds of ways. And that's all that I'm trying to advocate as well, is that we need to begin to listen to ourselves. And see, part of my agreement with you is that, yes, as human organisms, we're designed more to fit 15,000 years ago than we are to fit today. Is that our psychology, our whole biology and genetics hasn't caught up with us in many ways.
Yes.
And that's part of the tension we're in.
Yes, and my point is that the corporations, more than any tool that man has created, have given us the Peters. That Peter is not sitting somewhere on a fortification fighting savages, that Peter is on public radio articulating an extremely important and interesting idea. And the Peters have come to man to the largest extent because man's intelligence has given him the will and the wherewithal to create corporations which have facilitated creative, efficient, no-nonsense action.
Well, let's let Peter have a word.
Thank you. Sounded like I got a lot of acknowledgement in that last statement. A couple things. One thing that Fuller said in one of his latest books, that at the time when there were about 150 countries, that we often have about 150 admirals out there, implying the heads of state, that are all trying to run the ship of government and actually acting as blood clots to the free flow of information and resources, because they only see their purview, their mandate, as going to their political boundaries. And we now have a technology of transmission of basically this interconnection of power systems, and it really is our most fundamental element, this electron that nobody has ever seen. It's too small. It moves at the speed of light. It's just instantly there. So it's a unique animal in that it's physical and metaphysical, if you will, I think applicable to Dr. Kyle's book.
Mm-hmm.
And that we now have a technology that spans far beyond political boundaries in its technical ability to actually interconnect countries. And I think a wonderful example of this was just recently, just 2 months ago, when Arafat and Rabin in the White House shook hands and said, "We will now make peace." Newsweek, 1 week later, in a column about wealthy Palestinians now going back to build their homeland, in that article, they had a section called "Dreaming Peace Projects," dreaming up peace projects, and the number one listed activity in that category was the power grid interconnection between Israel and its Arab nations would save millions of dollars for both. So once we can get over the political hurdles, just as when the Berlin Wall came down in November 89, 2 months later, East and West Germany start interconnecting their power systems because it makes good economic sense to do that. I think business has a very great opportunity to really drive us in a direction of global peace. As John Nesbitt said in his book, Megatrends of a Decade Ago, the fastest way to world peace is through world trade. You just don't want to shoot your customer or supplier. It's bad business.
Mm. I'd like to thank you both for joining me today.
Thank you.
Dr. David Kyle joined us by telephone from the Pacific Northwest. His book is Human Robots and Holy Mechanics, Reclaiming Our Souls in a Machine World. Peter Meissen is founder and director of special projects for the Global Energy Network International, based in San Diego, GENI. You can reach them if you're interested in finding more information by calling. It's a local call, 595-0139. These days on KPBS Radio, I'm Dan Irwin. These days in San Diego, America has many symbols: the Statue of Liberty, the Capitol building in Washington, the Grand Canyon. Thanksgiving has its image too, and that's the turkey. However familiar Thanksgiving turkey is for most of us, it was a shock 1 year for Steven Silverman.
As a city boy, most of what I know of country life was gleaned from books and movies, except for one Thanksgiving. For a reason lost in memory, my father was given a Thanksgiving turkey. Now, this was not a genteel plastic bagged turkey, but a large live one, the kind that really did spit the equivalent of gobble gobble. He was large and mean-spirited and totally disinterested in friendship. For the day or two that he lived with us, the turkey stayed in the basement.